First Samuel tonight, chapter 21. Going through chapter 20 on Sunday was interesting for me personally, because reading that chapter through, and as I've read it before and studied it, knew the content of it, I was aware of the theological and doctrinal instruction that's in that chapter. But what I wasn't ready for this time around was what the Lord was going to reveal afresh to me. And in that chapter where we saw the struggle between King Saul and David being, in a sense, played out with Jonathan in the middle, and that picture of the old man, King Saul, and the new king of the people, David, picturing, of course, our Savior. I was struck again with that reality that, man, there's more to this thing called the Christian life, isn't there? There's more to this than simply saying, yeah, I'm with you. I'm one of the Christians. I'm one of those. You know, I go to church and everything. I do, you know, I have a Bible and stuff, and once in a while I don't mind people seeing me with it. You know, and we tend to equate our Christianity with those types of things oftentimes, you know, and we're guilty of it too, folks, here on occasion. You know, we carry our Bibles around, maybe perhaps, as an evidence that we're really spiritual and we're not just one of those, quote unquote, Christians, you know, that says they're a Christian but doesn't prove it by carrying their Bible everywhere they go. So we have to be careful as well. We can't just put on the outward thing and say, yeah, look, see, I'm deeper than everybody else because I actually do carry my Bible. I actually do, you know, do these things. I pray in public, you know. I pray over my meals in restaurants and make people notice it. I know the deal. I you know, I do it too. You know, I like people to know that I'm a Christian, you know, and somehow, though, we can't get that mode set in our thinking that that's all there is to it. It's much more than that. And we saw in the story on Sunday that Jonathan, bless his heart was with David, but he lived with Saul. And our hearts are with our greater than David, Jesus. But we live here. You know, and we have our own Sauls. We have our own set of things that would interfere or pull us away, you know, from our greater than David, Jesus. And it's important that we study these things because, man, it wakes us up occasionally to the reality of what it's really about. You know, and there's some shocking things, I think, waiting for us all when we get to heaven. The stark reality of what it really meant. What we could have lived and what we could have had and all those things. And again, not that we're going to be bummed in heaven. Nobody's going to be bummed out there in heaven going, oh man, you know, you don't see the long faces and all that in heaven. But there will be a reality, I believe. That day when the judgment seat of Christ is proclaimed, and we're not judged for our sin, but simply what we did for him. I think in regard to hearing that wonderful phrase, well done, good and faithful servant, which we're all longing to hear, there will be an immediacy of a knowledge, I believe, within us of what was well done. What did I do that was well done? Lord, that was your doing. You did everything well. It was you. And we will know that, I think, within. But people say, well, that's great, but you know, I mean, he's not going to bawl you out anyway, no matter how you lived, right? So what's the big deal? Why not just live our lives and be, you know, the so-called Christianettes or whatever, like J. Vernon McGee used to say. You know, taking in sermonettes, for us Christians. What's wrong with that? Why don't we just be that? I mean, it doesn't matter. He's not going to get mad at us. No, he'll never do that. He'll never hold you accountable for your sin or your neglect of him. But you will know, and I will know. And this life, guys, is the only one we've got. This is the only shot we get at what? It's not going for the gusto. It's not live it to the fullest so you get the most out of it. That's not the one shot we get. We get one shot at this life to bring glory to Jesus Christ. That's it. Well, what about eternity in heaven? Eternity in heaven is where the glory is enjoyed. It's not made there for us. It's made here for him. And we get this one opportunity, and every day is a great chance to bring glory to Jesus. And that's how we ought to look at this life. What can I do for you today, Lord, that would actually bring honor to your name and cause people to know who you are to a greater degree? You know, part of our little statement of faith that we have on our bulletins on the back, we are here to know Jesus Christ in an ever-increasing measure and to make him known. That's part of the function that our church has in its statement of faith, so to speak. That's what we're here for. And really, that's what we're all here for. How is it in the last year that my life has made Jesus Christ known to a greater degree to anyone? Now, that's a tough question, I know. But it needs to be dealt with, I think. And this is what that whole chapter did to me on Sunday. It just shook me to the core again. What is it that we do that really brings glory to Jesus? So we saw that Jonathan loved David, but had to deal with Saul just like you and me. We have to deal with our old flesh, our old man, our old, you know, person that is sinful and wicked and wants to ruin my life and your life, and we have to deal with him. But we love David, don't we? We love Jesus. We want to be with him. David parts from Jonathan at the end of chapter 20. And David, it says, verse 1 of chapter 21, came to Nob. That's a city, a town, which is about 3 miles south of Gibeah. That's where Saul lives, in Gibeah. So this isn't far away. It's where the tabernacle has been moved and set up. So the tabernacle's at Nob, and David goes there, and he looks up, verse 1 says, Ahimelech, the priest, the high priest, actually. And Ahimelech was afraid at the meeting of David, and said unto him, Why art thou alone and no man with thee? In other words, David, where's your entourage? You're from the royal court. David was an honored court man, or whatever you want to call him, with King Saul. He was among the elite of Israel, sat at the king's table. So everywhere he would normally go, there would be important people with him. And there's nobody with him but a few stragglers. A few guys are hanging around with David at this point. No entourage, and it scares Ahimelech. It bothers him. Where's all your people? Where's all the pomp and circumstance that normally goes along with you? And so David says unto Ahimelech, the priest, the king hath commanded me a business. And he says, let no man know anything of the business whereabout I send thee, and what I have commanded thee, and have appointed my servants to such and such a place. So David says, well, here's the thing. The king told me not to say anything about this. It's like top secret. I'm James Bond. And Ahimelech, I'd tell you what I'm up to, but I'd have to kill you. You know, it's one of those things. David's acting like he's some stealth super sleuth spy, you know. And he's like, yeah, I can't tell you. I'm on secret mission. And I told all the entourage to go somewhere else. That's why I'm alone. So basically, he deceives the high priest. Why? And people have tried to justify this particular maneuver, but really it's just plain old distrust. He doesn't believe God's going to be able to work things out, and so he tells this story, deceives the priest. And guys, I'll tell you something. This is something that people do constantly. They justify telling something that isn't true because they believe that if they tell the truth, it will be bad news for them. The consequences of telling the truth are too stiff, therefore, I'll lie about it, right? No big deal. And people try to justify themselves in this. And you've done it. And I've done it. We've tried to maneuver something, shift something, and justify why we said this, because if we tell the truth, it would be too much. It would be too disastrous, or it would be too harmful. Have you ever thought that through? When the time comes for you to have to make a tough choice about something and say the truth, even though it's going to mean higher taxes. Ooh, that was a sore spot there. I mean, I could say this, but I mean, after all, it was going to cost me if I say that. So I can just say this and, you know, it's okay. Is it? Are we willing to tell the truth no matter what the consequences, or do we just do what David does here and say, well, I'll just tell a little white lie. Doesn't matter. It's better for me, after all. So, here's what happens. By the way, this little incident, him not telling Ahimelech the truth, is going to cost dearly. Not David. Ahimelech. It's going to cost him. Always does. Always costs when we do that. And the priest answered David, verse 4, and said, there is no common, or I'm sorry, verse 3. David says, now therefore, after he tells him this story, he says, now therefore, what is under thine hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in mine hand, or what there is present, or whatever you've got. Give me some bread. What have you got? Basically, we would say. And the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread under mine hand, but there is hallowed bread. In other words, I don't have any regular bread. There's bread from the table of showbread, the hallowed bread, the bread sanctified, set apart for the Lord. Remember in the tabernacle, the 3 places that the priest served, the table of showbread, which represents the word of God, the bread that comes down from heaven, as Jesus depicted. That is the manna, or the bread that we eat. Give us this day our daily bread, right? It's the word. And then there was the altar of incense. It was right up against the curtain into the Holy of Holies, where the prayers are represented. And then there was the golden lampstand on the other side of the room, across from the table of showbread, which of course represents the light, or the shining forth, the witness of the believers, the light that's empowered by the Holy Spirit, the lampstand, you see. So the table of showbread was a table full of bread that was preserved for the Lord for a week. And then the priest ate it. It was for the priest. So here Ahimelech says, I don't have any regular bread, only bread from the table of showbread. And then he says this, well, if the young men have kept themselves at least from women. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, back in Exodus chapter 19 and Leviticus 15, you can look it up if you want, but that is where a man would have to keep himself 3 days from a woman before he could be considered clean. So, in other words, when it came to the solemn feasts and the things that were offered to the Lord, that was the way it was. It's nothing against you women that this was said. It was a means by which the Lord was declaring, if you're going to be solemn unto me. I need you to keep yourself focused on me. And, you know, like it or not, gals, men are distracted when you're around. And it, again, it's not a slam on women. It's just a reality that happens. And of course, for some of you gals, when men are around, you're distracted. That's the way it is. So the Lord said there, you keep yourself free from that, from women, meaning you don't have intimacy sexually with your wife for 3 days during these times. It was a set apart time. And so when he's asking about sanctified bread, the priest says, well, wait a minute. Where are you guys at? You know, have you kept yourself holy? How you doing? You know. And David answers, verse 5, the priest and said unto him, of a truth, women have been kept from us about these 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy. Their bodies are holy. They've been with me, David says. They've been walking with me. Now, this is a great picture. David says, these guys that are hanging around with me, they're holy. They're clean. It's a great thing. What, now, were they perfect? Were they holy men? Well, the picture is great because, no, they weren't. They weren't perfect, but they were hanging around David. And for you and me, we're not perfect either, are we? But are we holy? Yeah. Why? Because God said so. We're covered by the blood. And when we are around Jesus Christ, when we're part of him, we're holy, even though the reality is we're not really all that holy of people, but we're set apart, imputed with righteousness. It's awesome. These guys hung around with David. David says, hey, they're holy, and their vessels are holy. Their bodies are holy, and the bread is in a manner common, yea, though it were sanctified this day in the vessel. Now, what he means is the bread's kind of becoming common because the week's up. David's, you know, he knows the ordinances. He knows the law. He knows the way this works. Hey, this bread's been sitting out a whole week anyway, so it's kind of common. I mean, it's kind of ready, isn't it? It's kind of ready to eat. Now, if you recall, Jesus brought issue to this particular part of Scripture when he was accused by the Pharisees, him and his disciples, of eating. Remember? They went through the field and grabbed ears of grain and rubbed them in their hands, remember, and were eating them and so forth. And Jesus said, don't you know what happened when David went into the tabernacle and ate the showbread? He said, don't you recall that? That wasn't illegal for him. Jesus was bringing up something that the Pharisees had to agree with because they knew the story. And the fact was is that he didn't desecrate or cause there to be some kind of problem lawfully because he ate that showbread. Neither did Jesus and his disciples by eating on the Sabbath, because Jesus said in that passage, I am Lord of the Sabbath. You know, Sabbath wasn't meant to be a bummer for people. It's meant to be a blessing. It's meant to be a break. Take a break today, God said. And man made it a rule and a regulation and a bummer, you know, as we often do. So it's almost common, you know. I mean, the day is almost done and you know, it's time to change the loaves anyway. So the priest gave him hallowed bread, for there was no bread there but the showbread that was taken from before the Lord to put hot bread in the day when it was taken away. So he was right. They put some hot bread there after they took that other off. So it was time. In other words, it was time to change the bread. Now, a certain man, servant of Saul, was there, verse 7, that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg, and he's an Edomite. Now, Doeg is going to play a part in just a little bit more fully. But just to kind of give you a precursor, Doeg, his name means fearful. And kind of the secondary meaning of his word is he acts uneasy. He acts uneasy, and his name means fearful. He's the kind of guy that when you look at him, you kind of look sideways at him. He makes you kind of feel like your skin's going to crawl. You know what I mean? And he acts skittish. He's a guy that when you look at him and talk to him, you wouldn't trust him with anything you had. He's that kind of guy. Makes you feel awkward, funny, and he acts skittish and uneasy, and he's not trustworthy. And his name, and this will play in later, means fearful. So keep that in mind. Now, he's there. He's an Edomite, and he's the chiefest of the herdsmen that belong to Saul. And David said unto him, Ahimelech, and is there not here under thine hand spear or sword? After he gets the showbread, he asks if there's any weapons. For I have neither brought my sword nor my weapons with me, because the king's business required haste. Now, this is really stretching it. I was in a hurry because, you know, the king said, get moving. So I left my sword and all my weapons. Not likely, David, you see. And the priest said, well, the sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom thou slewest in the valley of Elah. Behold, it is here wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If thou wilt take that, take it. For there is no other save that here. I don't have any other weapons. But that sword you used to lop off the head of Goliath is here. This must have been a big sword. You know, I always pictured David kind of trying to pick that thing up, you know. I mean, if Goliath's spearhead weighed like 15 to 20 pounds, what does sword weigh, you know? So David asks about weapons, and the priest says, well, we've got Goliath's sword there wrapped up in a cloth behind the ephod. Now, what's it doing there? I don't know. I do know this. The spiritual decline of Israel was a mess, and they could have done some weird thing with that sword, put it with the hollowed things, you see, trying to make more of the sword than it was supposed to. Probably not an unlikely scenario. So he says, hey, if you want the sword that you took off Goliath's head with, there it is, you see. There's no other weapons here. And David said, well, there is none like that. Give it me, or give it to me. He said, there's no other sword like that around. That thing's huge. I'll take it, he says. And so David arose and fled that day for fear of Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. So fear has replaced faith a little bit here in our brother David. He's starting to move on fear, not faith. He takes off for fear of Saul, and guess where he goes? He runs 20 miles away to Gath. Now, what's Gath? It's the home of Goliath. So he shows up in Gath with Goliath's sword. Now, he's not thinking straight. And fear never allows you to think straight, folks. Do you know that? You cannot navigate your life on fear. You start doing stuff like this. You run right into Philistine country with the Philistine's own sword in your hand. You know, now that's kind of a giveaway, isn't it? Now, people are going to be looking at David and looking at that sword and, dude, that's Goliath's sword. You know, what are you doing with that? Right? Well, that's exactly what happens. By the way, Psalm 34 and Psalm 56 were penned during this next section, or they pertain to it. And throughout this chapter, many of the Psalms that you read and I read were written based on the things that took place in this particular chapter. And if you read those in conjunction with this, you'll find it's interesting. Now watch what happens. So David goes right to Gath with Goliath's sword, and the servants of Achish, the king there, said unto him, is not this David? The king of the land? That's interesting that they're calling him the king before Saul would. They already know he's the king. Even the enemy knows who the king is. The Bible says even the demons know who Jesus is, and they tremble at the name. I mean, they're just scared to death. And they knew he was the king. He said, is not this David, the king of the land? Did they not sing one to another of him in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands? Now, David's heard this particular thing before, and it's no wonder that it troubles him. Because the last time he heard that, Saul tried to kill him for it. Remember? The song didn't please Saul. So watch what happens. David laid up these words in his heart, or pondered it for a minute, and was sore afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. Fear struck David severely when he heard the song, as they kind of probably repeated it. Hey, they sang this song. Hey, David's killed his tens of thousands. Hey, and he just got scared to death because it recalled the issue with Saul. And now he's afraid of the king of Gath. And so watch this. He changes his behavior before them and feigned himself mad in their hands and scrabbled on the doors of the gate and let his spittle fall down upon his beard. So David starts acting crazy, and he starts drooling in their presence and just lets this drool drip down his beard, you know, and he starts scratching on the door, you know, and he starts acting like he's loony, you know, crazy. You know, he's just and drooling, you know, just, he's acting just nuts. Now, I'm telling you, folks, fear will drive you to do all kinds of things that you normally wouldn't do. I mean, normally David wouldn't act this way, but fear has got the better of him. And by the way, it's a dramatic picture of what happens to you and me. Now, not that when you guys come to me, you know, and you say, hey, I'm fearful, you know, you're drooling on yourselves and all that. Most of you don't do that anyway. But the thing is, fear just does this number on you, and David here is acting the fool. And he's doing whatever he has to do, no matter how foolish it is, to get out of the fix that he's in. Some people model that in their lives. I'm in a fix. I'm in a struggle. I've got a problem. I've got issues, and I'll do whatever. I'll drool on myself. You know, I'll scratch the doors. I'll whatever I have to do, I will do it. Just let me out of this mess. And that's what David's doing, whatever it takes. Now, I want to read to you just a bit of the Psalms, because Psalm 56 is the prayer that David prays during this time. And I'll read it to you just quickly. It doesn't take but a minute. It's not a long psalm. The heading of Psalm 56 says this: to the chief musician upon Jonath Elam Rechem Mictam of David, or a song of David, when the Philistines took him in Gath. So there it is. This is when he was in their possession there, drooling on himself. Be merciful unto me, O God, he says, for man would swallow me up. He fighting daily oppresseth me. Mine enemies would daily swallow me up, for they be many that fight against me. O thou most high, what time I am afraid, I will trust in thee. Huh? What? Wait a minute. He's scared to death. It doesn't look like, when you go back to the story, that he's trusting in anybody, does it? And yet he says, I will trust in thee. In God will I praise his word. In God I have put my trust. I will not fear what flesh can do unto me. Whoa. It doesn't sound like that when you go back to the story. But this is the prayer of David's heart, he says, during the time he was facing the issue there at Gath. He says, every day they rest my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. They gather themselves together. They hide themselves. They mark my steps when they wait for my soul. Shall they escape by iniquity? In their anger, cast down the people, O God. In thy anger, cast them down. He was scared to death, but he was remembering God's promises. He says in verse 8, thou tellest my wanderings. Put thou my tears into thy bottle, and they not and are they not in thy book? And he says in verse 9, when I cry unto thee, then shall mine enemies turn back. This I know, for God is for me. In God will I praise his word. In the Lord will I praise his word. In God have I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. Now, it sounds to me like David is making sure that he's remembering what God has said to him, doesn't it? And it doesn't look like that as drool is running down his beard. It doesn't look that way when he's scratching on the door, acting foolish. But inside, David is trying desperately to remember God's promises. He says, "Thy vows are upon me, O God. I will render praises unto thee, for thou hast delivered my soul from death. Wilt not thou deliver my feet from falling, that I may walk before God in the light of the living?" Now, quickly, Psalm 34. A psalm of David when he changed his behavior. This is what Psalm 34 is heading is. He says, "I will bless the Lord at all times." Now, this is when he was delivered. This is when he wrote this psalm. "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad. O magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked unto him and were lightened, and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all his troubles." It sounds like during this time, David was doing a lot of praying. He's crying out inside. "And the angel of the Lord encampeth around about them that fear him and delivereth them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for there is no want to them that fear him. The young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing." And goes on to say in verse 18, "The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saveth such as be of a contrite spirit." All we can say is that David was there in that condition, acting like he was, and he was broken to pieces inside. And this is what you need to know, and I need to understand and keep in the forefront of my thinking. If my heart is broken before God, even though I act like a fool, he rescues me. He rescues me, even if that's true. And it is very often the case. It happened with David. It happens with me. It happens with us. So, again, he's there, and he's acting foolish. And you know, there he is. And verse 14, King Achish, this king, says unto his servants, "Lo," or "Yo," or "Whoa." He looks at David and says, "You see, the man is mad. Do you see this guy? He's crazy. Wherefore then have you brought him to me?" What in the world did you bring this guy in here for? You know, David's there just acting crazy. And he says, "Have I need of madmen? Do I need this today?" The king saying, "That you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence?" The king's just shaking his head. "What are you guys doing to me here? Did I ask for a madman to be brought to me today? I don't think so." "Shall this fellow come into my house? I think not." I mean, there he is drooling, you know, scratching the door. And the king says, "I don't think this guy's coming in my house. Forget it." And that's the end of that. David gets away because he acts this foolish part. And guys, I got to tell you, this is a picture of God's grace. Because you and me, when we act this foolish part out like we do so often, in the midst of that, even though it's a mistrust, it's a lack of faith, God still lets us escape oftentimes the trouble. And you know this is true. I would love to say that every time an issue comes at me, every time a challenge hits me face on and I get blown away by it, I'd love to say that, you know what? I never fear. I never drool. I never do anything like that. I just act so, you know, sophisticated, you know? Like, yeah, that's all right. I got it together. No problem. You know, I'd love to say that I never, you'll go, "Lord, help me." But I do. And you do too. We all do that. And we would like to say, oh, Lord, I won't act that part out. I won't be foolish, and therefore you'll deliver me quicker. And sometimes we do that. We act like we're really, I'm okay. You know, I'm all right. All right. Got it together. You know. And we think that if we act like we got it together, then God will say, all righty then, you got it together. And I'll just let you off the hook quicker because you look so cool. Forgetting that God looks right into the heart and he sees, even though you're like, I'm bad. That's right. Right? Isn't it true? And everything we try to do that would seem to be together, really, we're falling apart all the time. Anyway. And it's such a great thing for me to see this. God lets him escape. He lets him out of that place where he's going to be killed. If David would have tried to do something there, he was doomed. So he did whatever he thought he could do, and that was act like a crazy man and make him let him go, you know. And they did. The king said, get this guy out of here. So they let him go. Now, verse 1 of 22 says, David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave Adullam. And when his brethren and his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. So David took off and runs to this cave Adullam. Now the cave Adullam, the name Adullam means a witness or testimony. So this is going to be part of a testimony, a witness for David to be a part of. And watch what happens. And everyone, as David, now look at this is just amazing to me. David acts like a fool and does this foolish thing in front of the king and then escapes, you know, and runs away into this cave, which is a witness, which is a testimony. And what does God do? Everyone that was in distress and everyone that was in debt and everyone that was discontented gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them, and there were with him about 400 men. Now this, to me, just blows my mind. After that incident in Gath, David would be the least likely voted to be captain over an army, wouldn't he? I mean, would anybody say, hey, let's get David in there because, man, he drools really good. And, you know, he can really act like a crazy man when he wants to. I mean, that would not be the people's choice at that point. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because God doesn't care about that. And listen, folks, God doesn't care about what people think about you. When you are following after him, and failing sometimes, and miserably going through hard things because you don't know how to handle it. God's not real concerned about what people think about you. He just wants you to be concerned about him. And this is interesting to me. Psalm 57 was written from this particular cave. And really, Psalm 142 was the prayer of this particular time in the cave. David wrote a lot of psalms from the wilderness while he was on the run from Saul. You know that. Many of them were there in these caves. Now the cave, Adullam, they found caves that coincide kind of particularly with this particular region. And there's caves that are up in the hills outside of in Gedi and along the Dead Sea it's amazing. There's so many caves. It's so wild. And the cave that they believe is the Adullam cave has chambers in it that could easily contain 200 or 300 men. And so some of these caves were used by David, and all these men showed up. But look who shows up. He prays this prayer in Psalm 142, and you can read it. But the answer comes when David gets all these men to come to him. But here again, the man who just exhibited probably one of the most pronounced unfaithful acts by drooling on himself and all the rest, guess who he gets to come to him? Who are his army? Those in distress, those in debt, and those that are discontented. And it's interesting, isn't it? Do you think David's going to be able to relate to these guys? Oh, yeah. I think so. You guys should have seen me just about 3 days ago. You think you're distressed. You think you got problems. You should have seen me. I was, you know, crawling around the ground, doing weird stuff. I mean, he's going to relate to them, no doubt about it. But the greater picture here is, of course, David as a picture of Jesus and those that would come to him. This is interesting, isn't it? Who's attracted to Jesus? Who's attracted to David here? Distressed people. People in debt. People discontented. People with problems, issues. Those that are dealing with life and are totally unable to cope, they come to the Lord, and he becomes the captain over them, just like David does here. It's such a great picture, because this is who it is. This is who I was. This is who I am. Right? You? I mean, who comes to the Lord? I'm not discontented. I'm not in debt, and I'm certainly not distressed. Well, that person doesn't come, do they? Some of you are trying to get people like that to come, aren't you? People who, well, I don't need the Lord. I don't need him. I'm not distressed. I'm not bummed. I'm not discontented. I'm not in debt. I have no problems. I don't need Jesus. Really? And until somebody knows that's their condition, they don't come to the cave of Adullam, the cave of witness. They will not bear witness to that, unless they know that's their condition. Nobody comes to the Lord, folks, with pride boldly before them. Everybody that comes to the Lord comes bowed down, sometimes crawling on their face, saying, help me. I have nothing else. I am desperate. I need you. I need help. That's who comes. And David becomes their captain, you see. And of course, these guys are all outside the camp, aren't they? They're all outlaws, really. But doesn't Hebrews 13:13 say that? That we must come to him outside the camp and bear his reproach. These guys are all teaming up with David, even his whole family. And David went thence, verse 3, to Mizpah of Moab, and he said unto the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. So he goes to Moab and goes to the king of Moab and tells him, can my mom and dad stay with you until I'm done with this thing? Because they're old and they're not going to be able to get around with us. Can you just watch over them? Now, this is something that the Jews wouldn't normally do, would they? Go to Moab and ask the king of Moab to help them out? But let's not forget who David is. He's the great grandson of Ruth, who was what? A Moabite. So he's going back to his roots, back to great grandma's house. And tells them, hey, watch over my foot, which Jesse and his wife, David's parents, Jesse would have been just the grandson of Ruth. So he's going back to grandma's place. And so David brings them, and he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the while that David was in hold. And the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold, depart and get thee into the land of Judah. And then David departed and came into the forest of Hereth. So Gad, the prophet, says, you got to get out of here. It's not safe. And we'll see, why here in just a minute. So when Saul heard that David was discovered, here's why. Here's why Gad told him to get out of there, because Saul got wind of the fact that they knew where David was. His stronghold, his holdup was discovered, and he had to bail on that place. And so when Saul heard that he was discovered and the men that were with him, now Saul abode in Gibeah, again, under a tree in Ramah, having his spear in his hand. Not good. Not good. And look, all his servants were standing about him. I wouldn't be. Saul, spear, not a good thing. Time to go, see. And Saul's there with his servants, and Saul says unto his servants that stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? Will David do this for you?" Now, what's this all about? Well, his own men, his own servants, were questioning whether they should be with Saul. And Saul knows it. Plus, Saul's paranoid, as you've probably already guessed. He's got some real issues, trust issues. He doesn't trust David, and he doesn't think anybody else should be trusted either. And so he's always trying to figure out who's scheming against him, and he thinks his own men are. And so he's actually saying here, who's going to do this for you? And he wasn't doing that for him. But he's saying, I'll give you these things. It's a bribe. Be loyal to me, and I'll give you all this stuff. Well, we already know Saul's MO, if you would, was taking, not giving. Samuel said he's going to take everything you've got, this king that you wanted, to the people. So he's not a giver, but he's telling the people, hey, I'll give you this. Now, interestingly, when you read through the story later on, David's own men would die for him. And he didn't have a thing, did he? He didn't have a thing to promise him, to give him, but they would have laid their life down for David. That's the difference between David and Saul. Saul's here bribing his own men. Hey, don't turn on me. I'll give you more. Don't turn. I'll give you some more stuff. And they were wondering whether they should. And it's obvious because he goes on in verse 8, that all of you have conspired against me. You are all against me, Saul said. Every one of you, and there is none that showeth me that my son hath made a league with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you that is sorry for me. It's all about me, Saul says. It's all about me, and nobody's sorry for me. Everybody's against me. I'm going to go eat worms. You know, it's that whole pity party he's having right there in front of his men. No wonder they didn't respect him. You're all against me, and nobody feels sorry for me or showeth me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as this day. Nobody's even told me what's going on. And it's true, they weren't. They weren't saying a thing. If they knew something, they were keeping their mouth shut. Why? Well, they know by now that King David is already moving towards the throne. Now, think about it. If you were Saul's men, you know David's coming. His time is coming. Man, I better bail on this thing. Because when David gets into power, I haven't got a prayer if I'm on this king's side, you see. So watch this now. Then answered Doeg, there's our buddy, the guy that was there with Ahimelech, the high priest, and David. He heard all this, and David realized at that point back then that he was going to tell Saul everything. He already knew it. And Doeg, the Edomite, which was set over the servants of Saul, and said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub. I saw him there, Doeg says. And he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him victuals and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. Now, okay, this is partially true. He says he saw David with Ahimelech. True. He gave him a sword of Goliath. Also true. But he inquired of the Lord for him? Not so. That's a lie. And as we've said, a half-truth is all lie. Right? It's a total lie if it's a half-truth. People don't have that understanding well fitted in their hearts sometimes. Half-truth, all lie. So he says, hey, I saw him there, and the priest was making prayers for him. He was seeking the Lord. In other words, he got the Urim and the Thummim down, and he was sitting there seeking the Lord. He was doing that thing that he's only supposed to do, you know, when it's really crucial things that are happening. He was doing that for David. That was a lie. But he knew that would get King Saul mad, so he said it. Then the king sent to call Ahimelech the high priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests that were in Nob, and they came, all of them, to the king. And Saul said, hear now, thou son of Ahitub. Now that's a term that means he's trying to disgrace him. Rather than calling him his name Ahimelech, he calls him the son of Ahitub. Remember, he called David that, son of Jesse, right? It means, you know, you son of Jesse. See, that's what it means. And he's saying here, you son of a high tub or a hot tub or whatever he's saying. You you know, you that's who you are. Instead of saying his first name and saying, you know, Ahimelech, you know, you what did you do here? It's a total disgraceful event that he's trying to bring upon this man, this high priest. Now he's trying to disgrace the high priest. And so he says this. And his name, by the way, as we've looked at Ahimelech, his name means brother of the king. And Saul won't call him that. He calls him son of Ahitub, and Ahitub's name means good brother, but it doesn't mean brother of the king. So again, he's kind of cutting him off. You're no brother of the king. I'm the king. There's only king around here, and you're not my brother. That's what he's saying. And Saul said unto him, why have you conspired against me, that thou and the son of Jesse, in that thou hast given him bread and a sword, and hast inquired of God for him, that he should rise against me to lie in wait as this day? Why have you done this? You turned on me, and you've been conspired with David, and you've inquired of the Lord for him. In other words, you chose sides. You chose David over me. And it's interesting because Ahimelech, verse 14, answered the king and said, and who is so faithful among all thy servants as David, which is the king's son-in-law, and goeth at thy bidding and is honorable in thy house? Interesting that Ahimelech doesn't make any defense right here for himself yet. He simply says, you know what? David's awesome. You don't have any business slamming David. You don't have any business doing this. You know, he's awesome. He's been good to you, and he's been honorable in everything he does. Why are you doing this to David? He doesn't defend himself at this point. He just says, David hasn't done anything to you. No defense at this point for himself. Then he says, did I then begin to inquire of God for him? Did I do that? Absolutely not, he said. I didn't do that. That was a lie. Be it far from me, he says. Let not the king impute anything unto his servant. Don't impute that on me. I didn't do that, he says. But he doesn't take back anything about being with David. He says, you know, he doesn't say anything about that. He just says, I didn't inquire, you know, the Lord about him. He says, don't impute that to me, nor to all the house of my father. Don't bring my family into this. For thy servant knew nothing of all this, less or more. I had no idea that this was going on between you and David. I didn't know what was going on. He shows up, and I gave him some bread and a sword. That's all. But he's a great guy. He's awesome, and I don't know what your problem is with him. You know, I don't know what the trouble is here. And the king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. You're going to die for that. Now, he's really going over the line here. He's been trying to kill God's anointed, David, the king, to be. But now he wants the high priest dead and all his house, meaning every single priest. you're going to die for this, you and all the priests. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand also is with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not show it to me. The footmen standing there, the guards closest to Saul and the men standing there, are instructed by the king to kill these priests. But the servants of the king would not put forth their hand to fall upon the priests of the Lord. Sounds like when King Saul tried to kill Jonathan, remember? Let's get him! Get Jonathan! And all the people went, no way. We're not killing Jonathan. Jonathan's great, you know. You're the loser, Saul. And they wouldn't kill him, right? And now the footmen, do you see where they're at here? They're not with Saul. His men aren't with him. When he gives an order, they're like, don't think so. We're not killing the priests. No way. Right? But watch what happens. The king said to Doeg, what does his name mean? Fear, fearful. He tells fear. He tells fear, turn thou and fall upon the priests. You do it, Doeg. You do it. And Doeg the Edomite turned and fell upon the priests and slew on that day 85 persons and did wear a linen ephod. In other words, 85 men were killed that were wearing the linen ephod. The priests. Doeg slew 85. In other words, in the reality of this is really staggering to me. Fear is what wipes the priests out. Peter says, you and me, we're a royal priesthood. And I'll tell you something. The thing that wipes us out is fear. That's what gets you and me. Remember, we've talked about this. Fear and faith can't live in the same heart simultaneously. One will drive the other out. If you're fearful, then faith isn't really being lived out. If you're faithful and you're exercising faith, then fear cannot dwell there. But isn't it interesting that the old man, Saul, listen, the old man, the old nature, actually gives instruction to fear to take you out as a priest. How so? What do you mean by that? Well, it's interesting, isn't it? What does the old man tell you and tell me when he wants his way? You can't stop watching those movies. Life won't be any fun anymore. You can't stop drinking that. It's not worth living if you can't have that. You can't stop the other. You can't deal with this. It'll scare you. It will be over. It won't be the same. Life won't be fun anymore. Whatever it might be, it's not going to work out. You can't tell the truth. What are the circumstances going to happen? You can't not cheat on your taxes. What kind of tax are you going to pay if you do that? Whatever it is. And I'm not on the I don't know what the tax thing is tonight, but maybe somebody in here needs to pay their taxes. I don't know. But the point is, what is it that happens to our old nature when we start to grow as priests? He sends fear to take care of the job. Fear is what wrings your neck, so to speak. It paralyzes a Christian. It paralyzes people. People don't, did you know that people won't walk with the Lord, not because they don't have enough knowledge about the Lord, but because they're afraid? It's fear. Fear keeps you from being a powerful testimony for Jesus. Fear keeps you and me from walking with power in the Lord. It's fear, folks. Whatever it might be that comes at you in this life, whatever situation you might find yourself, well, I'm with these people, and I thought about saying something about Jesus, but, you know, they looked mean. So I didn't say anything. That's okay, all right, no problem. So what motivated you was fear. and your old man used it against you, just like Saul does here. And that's what wipes out the priests of the church. That's what causes the priests to be dead, so to speak. And we've got a lot of dead priests in the body of Christ because there's a lot of fearful people. That's what's used here. And the picture is really staggering. The king said unto Doeg, hey, fall on these and wipe them out. And so he did. But watch what else he does. Without instruction, first he kills the 85 at Saul's order. But then Nob, the city there where the tabernacle was, remember where David was in the beginning of the story? Nob, the city of the priests, he smote with the edge of the sword both men and women, children and sucklings, babies, and oxen and asses and sheep with the edge of the sword. Doeg, this is the part that really just troubles me deeply. First, the priests are taken out with the fear, and guess who's next? The kids. The wives, those that are family members, right on down to the babies, right on down to the animals. The whole thing gets messed up. It gets wiped out. And guys, I have to say this in particular to you men tonight. In our story, it was the men that were the priests. However, in the body of Christ, we're all priests, men and women. Now there's no difference, men, women, Jew, Greek, whatever. But back then, it was the men. The men were the priests, and when they were taken out by the fear that was appointed to them and wiped them out, back home, the families were wiped out next. And it's really in a staggering way up to us men in so many regards. And I know that's something some of us don't want to hear. We don't necessarily like this particular type of teaching. We don't like this kind of theology because it's hard for us to understand. It's hard for us to take in the fact that fear in your life and in my life as men will not only take us out, wipe us out, but it wipes the families out that we're in, that we're supposed to be overseeing. I love the verse that the Philistines used on themselves, and I've adopted it because it's such a right thing to say. And the Philistines, remember when they were fearful of David and all the rest, they said, quit yourselves like men and fight. Remember? That was the Philistines talking. I like it. And sometimes I have to say that to me. You know, when fear starts to grip, when things start to happen, I have to say, quit yourself like a man and fight. Quit messing around with stuff that doesn't have any productivity spiritually in your life. Quit messing around, letting fear take you down, because here's the issue, folks, and I want to stop right now, but I'm not going to. Here's the thing. This is something that it's very important that you hear this. Psalm 51. David. It's the psalm where David wrote about his sin with Bathsheba. You remember, it's one of the most famous psalms. I want to read you something that David says in the end of that psalm. When he says, cast me not away, verse 11, from thy presence, and take not thy Holy Spirit from me. Right? He says this, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation and uphold me with thy free spirit. Right? Restore the joy of thy salvation, Lord. And he says this, then will I teach transgressors thy way, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. What happened with David was this. The first half of this psalm, he says, I acknowledge my transgression. My sin is ever before me. He says, have mercy upon me. I confess my sin. I confess it again. I'll confess it again. He confesses, purge me, he says. Drive it out of me. Don't let me get by with this. All the rest, right? He's confessing his sin. But do you know what happened before David confessed his sin? Nothing. A whole year went by from the sin that he committed to the confession, and absolutely zero happened. This is why he says, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation as I make this confession, and then will I teach transgressors thy ways. His unconfessed sin left David in a state of fear, which stopped his mouth from witnessing for Jesus Christ. It'll do the same thing for you and me. And this is the thing, guys, for us men especially, don't you dare let something stand in the way that causes unconfessed sin to be part of your life, because it brings fear into your soul and it stops your mouth from witnessing for the Lord. And if that doesn't take place, if that doesn't happen, then the rest of the family suffers as well. It's just the truth. It's just the way it works. And I know it's difficult to hear that. But Doeg took out the whole town. He took out the whole group, you see. And one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And Abiathar showed David that Saul had slain the Lord's priests. What a terrible report. This one goes and tells David they're all dead. The high priest and all the priests, except for me. They're all gone. Saul took them all out. By the way, just a footnote, this is a fulfillment of prophecy. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 2, Eli, the high priest, remember? He was told, because of his family and the priesthood that was so corrupted, he was told that the whole thing was going to be what? Wiped out. The whole thing. And we think, well, how's that going to happen? It happened right here. This whole thing gets smeared right here. Terrible thing. But watch what happens. David said unto Abiathar, I knew it. David says, I knew it that day when Doeg the Edomite was there. Circle it, highlight it, mark it, men. He knew it when Doeg was there. There are times when you know it. When fear, when that unconfessed sin that brings the fear is there and you know it, David could have taken him out. And he didn't. He deceived, rather, the high priest Ahimelech. And guess what the result was? They're all dead. How many times have I said, I knew it? I knew it. I knew it if I did that. I knew it if I let this continue to be a problem. I knew it if I wouldn't confess it. I knew it if I didn't stop it. I knew it. And we have to do the same thing that David neglected to do. And that is, I knew it. I knew it. I know it. I know it. Not I knew it. Quit saying I knew it and start saying I know it. I know it, and I will deal with it now. I'll deal with it. I'm not going to allow any more the enemy to wipe out me and my family any longer. You see, know it. He says, I knew it when the Edomite was there, that he would surely tell Saul, I have occasioned the death of all the persons of thy father's house. I allowed it to be. Abide, he says, thou with me. Fear not, for he that seeketh thy life, or my life, seeketh thy life, but with me thou shalt be in safeguard. So David turns here and says, It's okay. Don't worry. You're going to be with me. And this is something that the guys, David, of course, here dropping the ball. He knew it, but didn't do it. But here's the thing. Jesus, the greater than David, he knew it and did it. And that's why now David turns again back into the type of Christ that he should be and says, I knew it and I didn't do it, but the greater than David did do it. What did he do? He knew that the sin, that the fear, that all the unconfessed sin, all that stuff would destroy you and me. So he did it. Did what? He died. He died so that we as priests wouldn't have to. And he says now to this one survivor, he says, hey, those that seek my life, seek your life. Just like Jesus told his disciples, didn't he? He said, hey, if they hate you, understand this. They hated me first. And when they try and kill you, understand, they tried to kill me. And those that would seek my life are going to seek your life. And folks, that is something that has never been taken back as a promise of God. Yea, they who shall live godly shall suffer persecution. If you're going to be his, then there's going to be some problems that he had with people that you're going to have with people. You're going to face those same issues. But here's the thing. You're safe. You're safe with him. And no matter how bad things are, don't you know that the safest place to be is in his will? Doesn't matter what's going on. Whatever's happening, the safest place to be is right beside the greater than David, Jesus, isn't it? It's a tough reality. But I'm going to ask something tonight that I believe truly the Lord wants some of us to just deal with. And I'm going to ask that you do something rather remarkable. And that is this. I want you to not just say, Lord, okay, you know, whatever I've done, I'm sorry. Although I know that's important. But I'm going to ask if you'd stick around and take communion to let the Lord just search your heart in a profound way and let him completely remove the fear by completely confessing the sin. And the reason I say that is this. Some of this body is absolutely powerless. And the reason that is so is because there is absolutely unconfessed, unrepentant sin. Absolutely. And what I want you to understand tonight is this. It's not you alone that's going to affect. It's going to affect this whole church. Everybody, all 85 priests were killed. And everybody's affected by that reality. If I harbor that within, if I hold back, it will affect the power. And I need to say this. We don't have any time to mess around with powerless churches. And this is something, and I'm not pointing the finger at church. I'm pointing the finger at me. And anyone who would say, hey, I'm a believer, but, you know, I'm not real keen on this whole idea of, you know, you're talking, you know, stuff here that, you know, it's like nobody else talks this stuff. Nobody else talks about that stuff. Who do you think you are? I've heard that. Who do you think you are talking about that stuff? We are in the last days. We are. Absolutely. No doubt in my mind. And what I would love to see happen is this body, this church, just be used in the most powerful, awesome ways, and let's run to the finish line and finish strong for Christ. And that's going to require something that maybe is hard for you to do, and that is let go of it. Because it's causing fear and it's causing weakness in the body. Not just in your own walk, it will do that, but it's also going to have an effect on this church. And I'll tell you, if we would do that, I don't know what would happen. But I'll tell you this, it'd be awesome. Whatever it is, it would be just really cool. I mean, it would be amazing what would happen. Well, how do you know that, you say? Well, because I've done it on occasion. I plan to do it again and again and again. I want every day to be completely surrendered to my Lord. And I know I've been to the cave Adullam. I know what kind of awesome things the Lord can do in that cave. He answers prayer, and he brings those in who are also going through that same problem, that same issue. And he'll use us to bring others in that are distressed, discontent. Well, we don't want them in here. People say, I don't know if we want a church full of people that are discontent, distressed, and in debt, especially they won't tithe. And you'll get used in ministering to them. You'll be able to share with them because, you know, you've been there. Maybe you are there. You know, I mean, that's the deal, isn't it? So I'm going to just ask that you do that tonight. Go to the table. Do something radical. Do something really radical. Lay it all down. And don't pick it back up. Get rid of the fear by confessing the sin. And your mouth will be opened, guys, to witness. Then you'll teach people about transgression and salvation. Then you'll do it. Something maybe you haven't done. Or haven't done much of. Wouldn't that be awesome? Wouldn't it be awesome? You just can't help yourself. You're just telling people about Jesus. I can't help it. Excuse me, pardon me. But do you know Jesus? Because I can't help it. You know? And people will look at you, you know, and think, man, this guy's drooling. Yeah. I drool now. When I sleep, I drool. Did I tell you that? I can't believe it. On both sides. I mean, I lay on one side and I roll over and both sides of my pillow are wet. And I'm thinking, what is wrong with me? I'm like David, but I'm not trying to act like that. You know, I had some drool on me before church, and somebody said, what, are you drooling on yourself? And I said, no, it's my grandson. He slobbered on me. And I thought, I can use that anytime because I'm always holding my grandkids. I can just, well, it's his drool. You know, he drooled on me, slobbered on me. Yeah. But now you know because I just spilled the beans. Let's pray.